on the question of origins are basically two independent but complementary presentations. So we're going to be hitting on different material in each of the two presentations, but it's going to kind of the second one is kind of going to build off of what we talk about in the first one. So I just want to let you guys know that if you were thinking about going to another session after this one, that's fine. You can do that. You're going to miss the second half. I'm going to kind of leave you on a cliffhanger at the end here today, so it'll give you a little incentive to come back. However, if you don't, if you're not able to stick around, I obviously am aware that there are some great other opportunities and speakers to hear. I'm actually thinking of skipping out myself to go hear somebody else. But I have with me on my table back there. I've got in my there's a 4-CD album called "Answering the Three Great Questions of Life." Every religion and philosophy in the world asks these three great questions of life: where did we come from? What is the meaning and purpose of life, and what happens after we die? And in that 4-CD album, two of those 4 CDs are dealing with this question of origins. And there is over 2 hours worth of lecture material on 2 CDs. So if you're interested in checking that out, you got to bail out early today, miss one of the two halves of this lecture, I just want to let you know that that will be available for you in the back. So everybody still having a good time? Yeah, staying awake and everything, and Gary hasn't put anybody asleep yet. I'm just kidding. I hope he's not in here. I don't know. Well, let's see. I'm probably the most tired person in this room. Let's open up with a word of prayer, and then we'll get into the material. And we got an exciting topic to cover, a very relevant, timely issue. So let's say a quick word of prayer, and then we'll get into it. Dear Lord, we thank you so much for this great conference that we're all being able to soak in so much good information. And I just pray, Lord, that this session will be another positive time for all of us to deal with a tough issue that a lot of people in our world are wrestling with. And I just pray, God, that you would help me to communicate clearly here and give us clear minds to think through these important things. So we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we are here this afternoon to deal with this question of origins. And obviously, there's been a lot of press over this issue in recent years. In particular, in the last year, it seems like this debate has really heated up. The whole intelligent design movement obviously has begun to play a factor in this question of origins debate. There have been numerous court cases. The Supreme Court has weighed in. School boards all across the country are wrestling with this issue. And so it's definitely very timely. For example, in the past year, National Geographic had a cover story titled, "Was Darwin Wrong?" It's very interesting. If you open up the inside cover, the very next page, in big, bold red letters, it says, "No, Darwin wasn't wrong." Well, today, as you're going to find, I'm going to argue for a little different conclusion. But obviously, this is a heated topic in our culture. This last fall, Time magazine had a cover story titled "Evolution Wars: The Push to Teach Intelligent Design." And this article was spurred after President Bush came out and declared his public support for the teaching of evolution the teaching of intelligent design in public schools. And it's very interesting. It's not only our president who's calling for this, but in survey after survey, over 50% of Americans in our country today are calling for the teaching of intelligent design side by side with evolution in our classrooms today. Not only do 50% or more in some surveys want the teaching of intelligent design to be taught side by side along with evolution, but according to most surveys, upwards of 80% of the United States population believes that there is a God who created the universe. So we're talking about a topic that is not only being debated in academic circles, but is definitely an issue that has a lot of popular appeal in our culture today. And the evolutionists are not going down without a fight. Wired magazine, you may have seen a year ago last winter, "The Plot to Kill Evolution: Inside the Crusade to Bring Creationism 2.0 to America's Classrooms." You know, and this is a typical typical tactic used by the evolutionary establishment to name call and ridicule people who embrace intelligent design or creationism. And, you know, they're responding to what I believe are some really solid attacks. And they're, in my opinion, running scared. The naturalistic accounts of evolution are really on the run because, as we're going to see today, the evidence is just not on their side. You may have seen this last year, the History Channel had a month-long special called From Ape to Man. And they promoted this in their commercials and in their advertisements. Has evolution made a monkey out of you? Has evolution made a monkey out of you? They had a four-week special on the History Channel. Has evolution made a monkey out of you? Well, according to Discover Magazine, they have. I picked up this issue of Discover Magazine in the Twin Cities Airport last February. I was going to Michigan State to do a lecture for a college Christian campus ministry on the question of origins, the scientific evidence for creation versus evolution. And I'm in the Minneapolis Twin Cities Airport, and I go to the newsstand, and the day I'm leaving to go to Michigan State to speak on evolution, I see the cover story of Discover Magazine, Testing Darwin, Scientists at Michigan State Prove Evolution Works. Well, I picked this thing up. I said, oh, man, I'm in trouble. I'm going there, and they just proved it. They proved evolution works. So I break out in cold sweats, and I shell out my $4, and I pick up the magazine, and I started looking inside, you know, what's the proof? Well, needless to say, I wasn't too convinced. We'll look at some of this this so-called proof later on this afternoon. But as we begin today, I want to deal with something that's fairly important for us to consider, and that is the reality of the impact of how you choose to answer the question of origins and how that will impact the way you view your life and the way you view others. Because the question of origins is not simply a scientific matter, but it is also very much a philosophical matter. And it has tremendous impact on the way you view the world. For example, how you answer the question of origins. And I deal with this again in this 4-CD album in the back, Answering the Three Great Questions of Life. But how you answer the question of origins, it will determine your value for humanity. You know, are you just an accident evolved from slimy algae? Or are you a unique creation of God? Made in the image of God. How you answer the question of origin will determine your basis for morality. You know, how do we treat one another? You know, if we're nothing but animals, why can't we live like the animals? You know, how you answer the question of origins will determine your meaning and purpose in life. It'll also determine your ultimate destiny. And I believe one of the reasons we see in our culture today so many social ills and social problems is because we have been raising entire generations of young people for the last 100 years to believe that they're nothing but accidents, that they're nothing but animals evolved from slimy algae, that their closest ancestors live in the zoo. And I just want you to think about what that will do to your outlook on life. If you believe you're nothing but an accident, if you believe you're nothing but evolved slimy algae. You know, we look around our society today and we wonder why in the last 20 years there have been 40 million babies scraped out of their mother's wombs by abortionists. Now, who cares? Nothing but animals. Nothing but evolved slimy algae. You know, we wonder why our professional athletes are running into the stands starting riots and brawls. You know, it's what the animals do. My football team in Minnesota had a little escapade out on the lake. You know, big sex party out on the boat, public boat, Lake Minnetonka in Minnesota. Hey, big deal. That's what the animals do. You know, nothing but animals. And then we wonder why we see our society living like animals. You know, I think the question of origins has a dramatic impact on many areas of life. And so that's one of the reasons I think it's important for us to consider this. But I want to deal, as we begin, what exactly is the theory of evolution? On the screen behind me, this is a picture I took out of a high school science textbook. This is a typical depiction of the theory of the descent of man, or sometimes it's called the ascent of man, the theory of evolution, starting from simple-celled organisms, gradually evolving to higher and higher levels of complexity, until we get to you and I sitting here today. But what exactly is the theory of evolution? Let me read an article that came out of a recent Newsweek magazine entitled, "We're All Lucky to Be Here." This describes the picture you see on the screen behind me. "We're All Lucky to Be Here" from Newsweek magazine. It is a picture we all carry around in our heads, the most powerful icon of the age of secular humanism, the line of the ascent of man. It begins with the bacteria just barely across the threshold of life, a tenuous scum on the primeval seas. Then climbing the ladder of complexity, protozoa, invertebrates, the fishes and early reptiles, followed by the mammals, which knocked off the dinosaurs, the early primates and their hominid descendants huddled around a cave fire. 3 billion years of progress directed toward the production of man. This view asserts that there is nothing inherent in the laws of nature that directed evolution toward the production of human beings. There is nothing predestined about our current preeminence among large terrestrial fauna. We are the product of a whole series of contingent events in the history of our planet, any one of which could have been reversed to give rise to a different outcome. We are, in short, like every other creature that ever walked or slithered across the earth, an accident. Now, doesn't that just make you feel special today? You're nothing but an accident. No different from any other creature that ever walked or slithered across the earth. But this is essentially the theory of evolution. Now, it's important to understand today when it comes to the question of origins. Before we get into looking at some of the scientific evidence, it's important to understand that both evolutionists and creationists have the same scientific data. Okay? It's not as if one group has data that the other group doesn't have. It's not as if we're looking at two different sets of evidence. We all have the same scientific data, but the question is, how do you interpret the data, and does the data better fit an intelligent design model or a creation model, or does it better fit an evolution model? Not only that, but is it more logical, rational, and scientific to believe in evolution or to believe in creation? These are the basic questions we need to ask ourselves as we begin to look at the evidence. And again, it's the same evidence that everybody has. We're all looking at the same set of circumstances, the same facts, the same realities. But how do you interpret the evidence, and which position best explains the evidence? That is what we need to talk about today. Now, here's the reality, friends. The whole intelligent design movement that's been taking place in the last couple of years, the fact of the matter is this. Intelligent design is really just asking for students to have the academic freedom to examine the evidence, all of the evidence that's available to every person in the world. Intelligent design is simply asking that students have the academic freedom to examine all of the evidence. But you see, today in our country, they're not allowed to do that. And that's one of the ironies that I find in our secular school system today, our public school system today, which claims to be so in love with academic freedom, and yet they're not willing to allow an equal footing, an equal voice to be heard, to offer an alternative position on the evidence. Well, let's get back to what exactly the theory of evolution is all about. The theory of evolution assumes an upward progression from chaos to complexity. Now, here's how the theory of evolution works. I already read that Newsweek article, but let me explain this a little bit more in case you're not very familiar with what exactly is the theory of evolution. The theory of evolution essentially begins about 15 billion years ago. 15 billion years ago, evolutionists say there was nothing. I want you to think about that for a moment. There was nothing. Nothing. All right? Absolute, total, empty blackness. Nothing. Okay? And the evolutionist says that 15 billion years ago, this nothing exploded. And out of nothing came everything. All the suns, planets, stars, the earth, the mountains, the trees, the rivers, everything in the universe came from nothing. And then this everything that came from nothing gradually evolved to greater and greater levels of complexity. Non-living matter becoming living matter becoming conscious matter becoming self-conscious, developing ethics, values, aesthetics, even a God consciousness. It's very interesting. I'll just, you know, tell you a little side note. I was in a debate this last winter back in the Twin Cities with an evolutionary professor at one of the colleges there in the Twin Cities. And prior to our debate together, we got together and had dinner and just kind of set the rules and decide what issues and areas we wanted to cover. And it was very interesting, the process of this conversation. This evolutionary professor, he made the statement to me. He said, "Jason, you know what the problem is with you Christians?" Maybe you've heard somebody say this before. He says, "You know what the problem is with you Christians?" He said, "You just have faith." You ever heard somebody say that before? He said, "You just have faith." And I said, "Well, that's interesting." I said, "You believe that 15 billion years ago there was nothing, and then nothing exploded, and out of nothing came everything." I said, "Tell me something. First of all, how does nothing explode? Secondly, how does everything come from nothing?" And I kid you not, the man's response to me, literally 5 minutes after he had made that statement to me, he said, "You must assume by faith that somehow this took place." I was sitting across the table, my jaw dropped. I said, "Are you kidding me? You must assume by faith that somehow this took place? You accuse me of having nothing but faith, and yet your whole theory of evolution is chock full of faith propositions." And he said, "Well, I don't want to talk about that." Well, needless to say, I brought that up in our debate. But evolution assumes this upward progression. It's very interesting. You may have seen Time Magazine. I believe this was from a couple years ago. Time Magazine had a story called "The God Gene," where now scientists are even explaining that our religious beliefs, our spiritual desires can even be explained through naturalistic evolutionary processes. So friends, the fact that you believe in God, that's just the next step in your evolution. You know, they found an area in your human DNA that explains where you've evolved to have this idea, this need for a belief in God. It's just a highly evolved area of human DNA. But the question we're going to ask here today is, what is the scientific evidence? You know, we all have the same evidence. We're all looking at the same data. Does it better fit an evolution model or a creation model? Let's ask the question, as Time Magazine asked, how did life begin? How did life begin? Now, I want you to understand something here, friends. As we look at the scientific evidence today for how life began, it's important to understand this fact. When it comes to the origin of life, you only have two options. You only have two options. There are only two possibilities. Number one, either life is the product of random chance events through the theory of evolution, or number two, life is the product of an intelligent designer, a creator. But there are only two possibilities. In fact, you can't even think of a third possibility. You are either a product of random chance events, or you're the product of an intelligent designer, a creator. And so we're going to look at the evidence. What makes most sense in light of the evidence? I'd like to begin our examination of the evidence today by looking at the question of the origin of life. You see, naturalistic evolution is based on a hopelessly illogical premise. The idea of spontaneous generation. Naturalistic evolution declares that life can arise from non-living matter. 4 billion years ago, the earth was basically covered in a large inorganic soup bubbling away. Blub, 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 blub. Suddenly, poof, up rose an amino acid. Blub, 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 blub. Poof, up rose another amino acid. These amino acids formed, created peptides, polypeptides, proteins. Proteins turned into RNA. RNA turned into DNA. And somehow, this non-living matter eventually, poof, turned into living matter. 4 billion years ago, bubbling away in this inorganic soup. Now, the idea of spontaneous generation was actually a widely held scientific view in our world for upwards of 2,000 years. In fact, it goes back to the ancient Greek philosophers who first proposed it. And the idea of spontaneous generation arose, first of all, because people used to observe that, for example, if you would leave a pile of rags and cheese in the corner of your house, and you let them sit there for a few days or a week, all of a sudden, poof, rags and cheese would what? Turn into mice, right? People used to observe that if you left a plate of meat out on your kitchen table after dinner, you let it sit there for a few days, after a few days, suddenly, spontaneously, poof, the meat would what? Turn into maggots. You leave the maggots there for a few days, suddenly, poof, the maggots would turn into flies. Life from non-life. People used to observe, if you go down to your local pond and take a jar and pull out some water from your pond, you take that jar of water home to your house and leave it up on your counter, and after about a week or so, that water would produce wrigglers, tadpoles, mosquitoes. Life from non-life. Well, friends, we laugh at this today, but this is a widely held view for over 2,000 years, going back to the ancient Greek philosophers. And it wasn't until about 140 years ago when a man by the name of Louis Pasteur, you might be familiar with his name, the father of modern-day biology. He's where we get the term pasteurization of milk. 140 years ago, Louis Pasteur and others, in a series of experiments, dispelled the notion of spontaneous generation, conclusively demonstrated that spontaneous generation is not true, is not scientific. In Louis Pasteur in 1864, he said this, and I quote, "Never will the doctrine of spontaneous generation recover from the mortal blow of this simple experiment." And friends, in the last 140 years, that statement has remained true. Evolutionists have no explanation for the origin of life through spontaneous generation. They have no explanation how non-living matter can turn into living matter. Now, friends, we actually have today in biology what is called a basic law of science called the law of biogenesis. If you take a class in earth science or biology, how many of you high school students here have taken a class in biology yet? If you go home and you check your biology textbooks, I'd be willing to bet you that within the first chapter of your biology textbooks, you will learn about what is called the law of biogenesis. See, this is based on Louis Pasteur's experiments. In fact, you'll probably read about Louis Pasteur in the very same chapter that you studied the law of biogenesis. What is the law of biogenesis? The law of biogenesis says that life only comes from life. Life does not come from non-living matter. Now, for you students here, you need to be ready to ask some simple questions in your classroom when your teacher starts teaching you evolution. You know, for example, when I was in high school, my teacher started teaching us spontaneous generation, that this inorganic soup was bubbling away and somehow the right chemicals formed together and they were struck by lightning and poof, they turned into living matter. Friends, you got to be able to ask your teacher some simple questions. Just raise your hand in class. Just say, "Excuse me, teacher. I just got a quick question. Didn't we read back in chapter 1 about the law of biogenesis? You know, remember when we were talking about Louis Pasteur? I got a quick question. How do you explain non-living matter turning into living matter when back in chapter 1 we read about the law of biogenesis that life only comes from life? Life does not come from non-living matter." I asked this when I was in high school, and one of my science teachers, their response to me was very interesting. They said, "Well, Jason, you must assume by faith that somehow this took place." I raised my hand again. I said, "Teacher, I'm not interested in your faith. I want to talk about the scientific evidence." You see, it's very interesting. People always accuse Christians when it comes to the origin of debate about having nothing but faith. But when you start pressing them on the scientific evidence, you find again that the theory of evolution is chock full of faith propositions. In fact, just to show you how true this is and how right Louis Pasteur was in that quote I read earlier, take a look at this. Back in 2001, PBS did a six-week series titled Evolution. A six-week series titled Evolution on TV, all right, about how evolution is the best explanation for the origin of life, all right? Richard Hutton, who was the producer of this PBS series on evolution, he said this about the fundamental flaw of naturalistic evolution. This was in a Washington Post online forum. The producer of a six-week series on evolution, listen to what he says. There are open questions and controversies, and the fights can be fierce. Just a few of them. The origin of life. There is no consensus at all here. Lots of theories, little science. That's one of the reasons we didn't cover it in the series. The evidence wasn't very good. Are you kidding me? You did a six-week series on the theory of evolution as the best explanation for the origin of life, and you didn't even deal with the starting point? Are you kidding me? You know, friends, that's like if you went to an architect and asked the architect to build you a house, right? And you asked him to draw out some blueprints for you, and you come back a week later, and you ask him to show the blueprints he's drawn up for you. And he shows you, he rolls out this blueprint, and it's got this elaborate house and windows and doors and all the rooms, and just looks beautiful. But between the house and the ground, there's this big vacant space. And you say to the architect, you say, well, what's this big space down here? And he says, well, that's the foundation. Well, where is it? Well, to be totally honest with you, I'm not quite sure where we're going to get the foundation for the house. What do you mean you're not sure? Well, to be totally honest with you, I don't even know how to do a foundation. Friends, at that point, I walk out the door and find myself a new architect. You know what I'm saying? And yet evolutionists expect us to buy into this huge grand theory, and yet they don't even have a starting point for it. If you can't get the ball rolling, you don't have a theory, friends, okay? If you don't have a starting point, you don't have a finishing point. Do you understand that? The starting point is critical. And to this day, the evolutionists have no explanation for the origin of life. I've been in debates with evolutionists, and I have never had anybody argue against that fact because they admit it. Richard Hutton himself, six-week series on the theory of evolution is the best explanation for the origin of life. We didn't even cover it in the series. Don't bother me with the facts. Just let me stick to my biased philosophical presuppositions of faith. Well, let's move on. One of the next things I like to talk about in the question of origins debate is I like to point out to people some of the evidence for design. You know, there's a lot of ways that you can demonstrate creation by an intelligent designer. You know, we could spend literally days talking about different techniques and strategies. One of the things I like to point out, and one of the things I think is really fun to point out, is some of the evidence for design. Because I think some of the evidence that we see for design in the natural world is really, really remarkable. So I want to look at three areas today, briefly talk about some from microbiology, and then some of human anatomy, and then some examples from the animal kingdom. All right, does that sound good to you? All right, let's just look briefly at some of the evidence for design today. I want to start out by looking at, for example, DNA, solving the mysteries of DNA. We are all familiar with DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. You see the double helix depicted in pictures as a double helix, the genetic code for life. DNA, which is absolutely essential for life. DNA is found in all living things. It's absolutely essential for life. But the interesting thing about DNA is that DNA can only be produced by pre-existing life. DNA is found in all living things. It's absolutely essential for life, but it can only be produced by life. Okay? Now, students here, again, you got to ask your evolutionary professors some simple questions. When they start teaching evolution, again, just raise your hand. Say, excuse me, teacher. How do you get complex structures like DNA which are absolutely essential for life, but can only be produced by life. How do these things arise from non-living matter? You know, DNA has become a real problem for the evolutionist because they have no explanation for how these complexities could have arisen from non-living matter. It's absolutely essential for life. It's found in all living things, but it has to be produced by pre-existent life. And evolutionists have no explanation for how this could have come about. It was very interesting. You might have seen recently, just this last week, National Geographic had a cover story. This is kind of a side note. National Geographic had a cover story, The Greatest Journey Ever Told, The Trail of Our DNA. Do you know that geneticists today have mapped out the human genome all across the world? They've taken genetic samples of people from all across the world. And do you know what they've discovered? They can trace back every single human person's DNA back to one original couple. Where have I heard that story before? You know, again, friends, don't bother me with the facts. Let me stick to my biased philosophical presuppositions of faith. You know, you start looking into some of this stuff, like the complexities of DNA. We don't have time to get into all this today. I have more information out on the table. But when you start to look into some of these problems, you begin to understand why people like Sir Fred Hoyle, who prior to his death a few years ago, he was the world's leading astronomer and mathematician. He just died a couple of years ago. He was the world's leading astronomer and mathematician. Speaking before the British Academy of Science, Sir Fred Hoyle said this, "Let's be intellectually honest. We all know that the probability of life arising by chance is the same probability of throwing a 6 on a dice 5 million consecutive times." You know, go home and try that sometime. He went on to say, "Let's be scientifically honest. We all know that the probability of life arising by chance through evolution is the same probability as having a tornado tear through a junkyard and form out the other end a Boeing 747 jetliner." You know, this guy was one of the world's leading scientists saying this. This isn't some wacky fundamentalist saying this. This was the world's leading mathematician and astronomer saying this before the British Academy of Science. Why does he say this? He says this because the guys who understand the complexities of structures like DNA recognize that this stuff couldn't have arisen by chance. There's no scientific explanation for it. Well, we could spend hours talking just about DNA. Let's move on. I want to talk about an issue before we get into human anatomy and the animal kingdom. I want to briefly talk about an issue which has come to be known as irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity, which is going to play into our human anatomy and the animal kingdom illustrations we're going to look at. Irreducible complexity is a term that was coined by a professor named Michael Behe, who I've had the privilege of meeting on a couple of occasions. And he wrote a famous book, a recently famous book called Darwin's Black Box, talking about a concept known as irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity and irreducibly complex system, it sounds complex, but here's what it means. It simply means a system that cannot function without the totality of all of its parts working together simultaneously. And many people, such as myself, believe that this has really become one of the ultimate challenges to evolution. See, these are structures so complex that all of their parts have to be initially present in a suitably functioning manner, all working together, or else the system falls apart. It doesn't work. These are all or nothing systems. It's either all there or it's not there. It doesn't work. They have to be all present. You know, a great example of this that Behe uses is the illustration of a mousetrap. It's an all or nothing system. Either every part of the mousetrap is there, working together simultaneously all at once, or else the mousetrap doesn't work. You know, think about it. To have a functioning mousetrap, you know, what part could you get rid of? You want to get rid of the holding bar? Not going to work. You want to get rid of the spring? It's not going to work. The hammer? It's an all or nothing system. It's either all there or it doesn't function. It doesn't exist. And when it comes to evolution, irreducible complexity is a problem for the evolutionist because according to the theory of evolution, biological systems evolved gradually, step by step, piece by piece. However, in the natural world, as we're going to look at in a second, we find evidence of literally thousands of these all or nothing systems systems that couldn't have evolved gradually, because if any part of them were missing, they wouldn't function. And evolution, survival of the fittest, tends to weed out systems that don't function. All right? So the only explanation for these systems is that they were designed. So let me show you a few examples of some of this evidence for design that I love looking at. Like the human eye, for example. The human eye is pretty remarkable. Charles Darwin once said, "To this day, the eye makes me shudder." And I really believe that that fact has remained true for evolutionists even to this day. Just think about how the eye works. You know, take the retina, for example. The retina contains photoreceptors called rods and cones. There are 60 million cones. This is in your eye, by the way. 60 million cones for bright light and color. 125 million rods for peripheral and night vision. These light-sensitive rods and cones cause photochemical reactions that somehow transform the light into electrical impulses. Some 1,000 million of these impulses are transmitted every second to your brain that turns them into images to take appropriate action. All by chance, amazing! You know, the eye has become a real problem for evolutionists. Now, here's the deal. There are people out there like Richard Dawkins, the famous evolutionist over in I believe he's in Oxford, London, England. Richard Dawkins, in a number of his books, he argues that you can explain the eye through gradual step-by-step processes. The problem is, when you ask the experts in the eye, they disagree with the evolutionists. For example, probably the world's foremost expert on the eye is a guy by the name of Sir Stuart Duke Elder. Sir Stuart Duke Elder, he wrote a book called The Eye and Evolution, which you can find in basically every medical school library. Most medical school bookstores still is. It is one of the number one texts on the eye, used in most medical schools. Sir Stuart Duke Elder, he's known universally around the world. Basically, he's Mr. Eye, okay? He's the guy when it comes to the eye. That was cool. That rhymed. Listen to what Sir Stuart Duke Elder says in his book, The Eye and Evolution. And by the way, this guy's no creationist, all right? Listen to what he says on page 246, as opposed to Richard Dawkins. "It would seem, therefore, that despite the considerable amount of thought expended on the question, the emergence of the vertebrate eye with its inverted retina of neural origin and its elaborate dioptric mechanism derived from the surface ectoderm is a problem as yet unsolved." He goes on the next page to say this. "Indeed, appearing as it does fully formed in the most primitive species extant today, and in the absence of transitional forms with which it can be associated, unless by speculative hypothesis and with little factual foundation, there seems little likelihood of finding a satisfying and pragmatic solution to the puzzle presented by its evolutionary development." What was he saying? Number one, we don't know anything about the evolution of the eye. And number two, we aren't likely to ever know anything about the evolution of the eye. Friends, this is Sir Stuart Duke Elder, found in all medical school libraries. Mr. Eye. You know, when Darwin says, "To this day, the eye makes me shudder," you know, think about what Darwin would say today if he knew all that science knows today about the eye. It's just amazing. The deeper you get into exploring these things, the more and more you begin to realize that these things are irreducibly complex systems. They're all or nothing systems. They're either all there or they don't work. They don't function. And again, the evolutionists themselves are admitting this. Sir Stuart Duke Elder. Well, let's move on and look at another example I'd love to talk about. The human ear. I think the human ear is awesome. The human ear. The way your ear works is, if you see on the picture behind me here, sound waves enter your ear canal. And the sound waves, here's an interesting thing, by the way, just to show you evidence of design. Take your finger for a second, all right? And stick it in your ear, right? All right? Your ear canal, all right, it's big enough to allow you to get in there and dig out your earwax, but it's not too big that you poke your eardrum out. I mean, if that's not evidence for design, I don't know what it is. But Think about how the ear works. It's amazing. Sound waves enter the ear canal, hits the eardrum. The eardrum sets three tiny interconnected bones into motion that move back and forth. These three bones, the middle ear bones, they actually are so small that they could fit on the head of a quarter, okay? They're that tiny. These three bones are pushed into motion by the eardrum. These three bones hit against that spirally structure that looks like a snail shell. They hit against that. That's called the cochlea. And there's fluid inside the cochlea that when those bones push against the cochlea, it causes the fluid in the cochlea to spin around, which rushes over little hair cells that are flowing throughout the cochlea. When that fluid rushes over that hair cells, those hair cells translate that movement into nerve impulses that are sent into your brain, where your brain interprets that as sound. All by chance. Isn't that amazing? Friends, the ear is an all or nothing system. What part of the ear do you want to get rid of? If this thing evolved gradually, explain that to me. What part do you want to get rid of to have a working ear? Are you going to get rid of the eardrum? Are you going to get rid of the three middle ear bones? The cochlea? What? It's either all there or it doesn't function. And again, evolution tends to weed out systems that don't work. So if this thing evolved gradually, how did it evolve gradually? Just like Sir Stuart Duke Elder says, we have no transitional forms to give us any clue about how the eye evolved. The same is true for the ear. And they're not going to find them because it's an all or nothing system. Now, it's very interesting, another little interesting side bit of information. Do you see on the in the top here of the ear canal, there's this structure. It's called the semicircular canals. It looks like kind of like deer antlers. You see what I'm talking about here, right in the middle of the picture? These things are awesome. This blew me away when I studied this. You want to talk about some sweet evidence for design. The semicircular canals, you know what they do? They control your balance, all right? So when you stand up out of your seat, you don't fall down. When you're walking downstairs or when you bend down to pick something, they control your balance. Listen to how these things work. These things, this blows me away. The semicircular canals, there's three of them, all right? One goes this way. The other one goes this way. And the third one goes this way. All right? What are the three ways your body can move? This way, and this way, right? Now, how do these things work? They work like carpenter's levels. There's fluid inside of these things and hair cells inside of these things. When you move, when you bend over, for example, the fluid in the vertical semicircular canal rushes over those hair cells. Those hair cells sense that movement, send a nerve impulse to your brain that tells your brain you're about to bend over, hang on so you don't fall. All right? Talk about amazing complexity in design. You just happen to have three ear bones going in the very three directions that your body can move that work like a carpenter's level to maintain your balance. I mean, it's just awesome. And friends, evolutionists have no explanation for how the ear evolved. Let's take a look at an example from, well, here's an interesting verse. You know, it's no wonder Proverbs 20:12 says, "The hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both." You know, why do we see this remarkable design? It's no surprise, friends. The hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both. Let's take a look at an example from the animal kingdom. How many of you guys like giraffes? I love giraffes, all right? I think giraffes are awesome. Giraffes can grow to be about 18 to 20 feet tall. I believe the tallest giraffe on record was about 23 feet tall. But these things are huge, all right? If you ever go to a zoo and see a giraffe, giraffes are they're the funniest looking creatures. They're just fun to watch. God definitely was having one of his like fun days when he invented the giraffe. But the giraffe is also a great example of irreducible complexity from the animal kingdom. And the reason for this is because the giraffe circulatory system is a complete mystery to the evolutionist. You see, the giraffe has a unique problem. You know, these things get to be 20 feet tall, right? Now, the problem the giraffe has is how is the giraffe going to get blood up into his brain 20 feet up in the air in order to supply oxygen for his brain so that he can live and survive? You know what I'm saying? Pretty big issue, right? Well, the giraffe solves this problem, pumping blood upwards against the forces of gravity, by having a huge heart. Giraffes have a huge 2-foot-long heart, just a giant, massive muscle inside their chest cavity. And the reason they need this huge heart pumping is because they need to push this tremendous volume of blood up their long neck against the forces of gravity to get to their brain. So they need this huge muscle to be able to push the blood upwards against gravity, right? Now here's the deal. That's pretty remarkable. But think about this. The giraffe has even a bigger problem now. Because here's the deal. The giraffe gets thirsty, right? So now the giraffe goes down to the local watering hole and he bends his neck down to get a drink of water. But now, instead of this 2-foot huge heart pumping blood against the force of gravity, now this massive muscle is pumping blood with the force of gravity. Well, what's going to happen to the giraffe when he bends his neck down to get a drink of water? He's going to blow his brains out. Right? But it doesn't happen. Why doesn't it happen? Because God designed the giraffe with a remarkable system. The giraffe, up through his neck, has a series of gates. Literally has a series of gates. And when the giraffe bends his neck down, these gates begin to close and shut off his blood flow to his brain one by one, blocking the flow of blood to his brain. He bends down, the gates close one at a time. The heart pumps, but the blood's not able to get up there. He has a little sponge in his skull that absorbs any excess blood that's up there for the time being. And then when the giraffe lifts his neck up, the gates reopen, the flow of blood is restored, and he's able to drink and survive and pump blood and go on happy throughout his day. Now, friends, some people have said to me, well, when I've lectured on this in secular university, they say, well, that's easy to explain. You know, the giraffe, he started out as like a cow or a horse, and you know, he needed to get to vegetation higher up in the trees, and so gradually he just grew, you know, his neck got longer and longer, and gradually he grew, you know, these gates just kind of developed over time. Good idea, right? Okay, here's the problem. Listen to what Stephen Jay Gould, who was our nation's leading evolutionist prior to his death a few years ago, listen to what Stephen Jay Gould says about the giraffe. By the way, Gould, who was our nation's leading evolutionist, he just died a few years ago, and he's now a creationist. But listen to what Stephen Jay Gould says about the giraffe. This was from Natural History. When we look to presumed sources of origin for competing evolutionary explanations of the giraffe's long neck, we find either nothing at all or either the shortest of speculative conjectures. No data from the giraffes then existed to support one theory of causes over another, and none exists now. He goes on to say, the alleged ancestral species are relatively short-necked, and the spotty evidence gives no insight into how the long-necked modern species arose. Friends, they have no explanation for how the giraffe evolved. There's no transitional forms. There's no missing links. What they find are short little horses, and then they find the giraffe, and there's nothing in between. There's no evidence for the evolution of the giraffe. And that's because God designed the giraffe. And it's an awesome example I love to point out to people. You know, again, you start to understand some of the stuff and you begin to see why people like Dr. Ernst Chain. Dr. Ernst Chain, who won the Nobel Prize for, he was the man who discovered penicillin, the curative properties of penicillin. Do you know penicillin has literally saved the lives of millions of people around the globe? I'm sure many of you in here have benefited from penicillin. Dr. Ernst Chain, the man who discovered penicillin, who won the Nobel Prize, he said this: to postulate that the development and survival of the fittest is entirely a consequence of chance mutations seems to me a hypothesis based on no evidence and irreconcilable with the facts. These classical evolutionary theories are a gross oversimplification of an immensely complex and intricate mass of facts, and it amazes me that they are swallowed so uncritically and readily, and for such a long time by so many scientists without a murmur of protest. Oh, no real scientist questions evolution. You ever hear somebody say that? Really? You ever heard of Dr. Ernst Chain? The man who discovered the curative properties of penicillin? The man who won the Nobel Prize? But I guess he's not a real scientist. You know? It's very interesting, friends. When you look at the history of science, most of the men who discovered the most essential scientific principles in the history of the world, they were all Bible-believing Christians who believed in an intelligent designer, a creator God. You go down the list. Dr. Ernst Chain, we talked about. Sir Fred Hoyle, we talked about. But Louis Pasteur, Bible-believing Christian, believed in Genesis. Sir Isaac Newton, Gregor Mendel, Copernicus, Galileo, Kelvin, Pascal, on and on. The most significant scientific minds. They were all Bible-believing Christians who accepted the fact that the world was created by an intelligent designer, a creator God. How much time we got left here? We're done? 1 minute? Gosh, you guys are killing me. All right. Here's the deal. We're going to skip over. I was going to move on to simpler things like the second law of thermodynamics. But I'm going to skip over this. I've got a whole section of this on my CD on the back table. And I want to talk, we'll close this section by looking at the fossil evidence just briefly, very briefly, unfortunately. Let me find my notes here. I'm sorry, here we go. Well, what about the fossil evidence? Now, here's the deal, friends. Since evolution has failed to explain, essential factors like the origin of life from non-living matter, the complexities of DNA, the problem of irreducible complexity, the second law of thermodynamics. Since evolution has failed to explain these important problems, what you often find is evolutionists turn to their last great hope, the fossil record. Charles Darwin wrote in his book, The Origin of the Species, that if evolution were true, we would expect to find countless numbers of transitional fossils demonstrating the gradual process of evolution. All right, now think about it. If the Earth is roughly 4 billion years old, okay, and if life has been evolving all of that time, we should literally be finding millions of examples of transitional fossils everywhere around the world. However, the fact of the matter is this. As of today, paleontologists, the people who dig and study fossils, explore fossils, they've only found an extremely tiny collection of fossils that could even be argued as being candidates for transitional forms. In fact, if we were to assemble all of the fossils, today's leading candidates for transitional forms, if we were to assemble those here today, they would all easily fit up here on this stage. What you need to understand, friends, is that we do not have museums full of transitional fossils. We do not have museums full of transitional fossils. The reality is we only have a small handful of highly dubious examples that people point to as transitional forms. In fact, you can go to any museum in the world, any fossil museum in the world. I've personally been to some of the largest fossil museums in the world, the British Museum of Natural History, the largest fossil collection in the world. You walk through the halls of the British Museum of Natural History. No transitional fossils. The Louvre in Paris. No transitional fossils. The Field Museum in Chicago. No transitional fossils. You know, go anywhere. Dinosaur National Park, Vernal, Utah. No transitional fossils. The fact of the matter is this. None of these museums have any transitional fossils on display which would demonstrate the theory of evolution as we see it on the screen behind me. Prior to his death, Charles Darwin himself noted the lack of transitional fossils in the fossil record. Darwin said this, and I quote, "Why is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory." End quote. Friends, 100 years has gone by since Darwin made that statement. All right? And things haven't gotten any better for the evolutionist in regard to the fossil record. If anything, the absence of transitional forms, transitional fossils, has only become even more glaring in the 100 years since Darwin made the statement. I mentioned this guy here, Stephen Jay Gould, who was our nation's leading evolutionist prior to his death a couple years ago. Stephen Jay Gould, who prior to his death, like I said, was our nation's leading evolutionist, he admitted the following. He said this, and I quote, "The absence of fossil evidence for intermediary stages between major transitions in organic design, indeed our inability, even in our imagination, to construct functional intermediates in many cases has been a persistent and nagging problem for gradualistic accounts of evolution. End quote. Friends, this was our nation's leading evolutionist saying this, admitting the absence of fossil evidence for evolution. Now, I mentioned that none of the world's major museums has any examples of transitional fossils. This is a picture of some apes from the British Museum of Natural History. For example, if you were to go to the British Museum of Natural History, the world's largest fossil museum on evolution, I was there just recently with my father. It's very interesting. If you visit the British Museum of Natural History, the world's largest collection of fossils, you will not find one transitional fossil anywhere in their museum. In fact, the late Dr. Colin Patterson, who was the senior paleontologist for the British Museum of Natural History, who wrote the book titled Evolution, in reply to a questioner who asked him why he had not provided any illustrations of transitional fossils in his book, he said this, and I quote, this was the curator of the British Museum of Natural History, he says, I quote, I fully agree with your comments about the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. End quote. Friends, this is the senior paleontologist of the world's largest fossil museum saying this. And you can see it for yourself. Go to any museum in the world. You'll see big displays promoting evolution. Big charts, posters, graphs, plaster Paris models, mannequins. You'll see all kinds of displays promoting evolution. But you won't find any transitional fossils. You'll see pictures, charts, lifelike models, human bones, animal bones, dinosaur bones. But friends, none of this is real evidence for evolution. You won't find any legitimate transitional fossils in any museum anywhere in the world. And this fact has become known as the trade secret of paleontology. You know, it's very interesting. I've been in debates before, and I've had critics of creationism make the claim that advocates of creationism misrepresent these scientists, and they take their quotes out of context. You know, what I find interesting is why are there so many quotes for us to supposedly take out of context? You know, if the fossils weren't really missing, why are all these guys making so many statements to the fact that they're not there? You know, if I'm taking their quotes out of context, I got a whole bunch I can pick from. You know, they're not making these statements because it's not true. They're making these statements because the fossils are missing. So what are these guys finding? What they're finding and what our museums are full of are fossils that show every type of creature created fully formed and functional without any sign of intermediate ancestors. We have thousands of fossils in our museums throughout the world, but these fossils do not demonstrate evolution. They demonstrate exactly what God's word reveals, that all things were created by God, appearing abruptly in six 24-hour days, fully formed and functional. Friends, the fossil record is not evidence of evolution. The fossil record is compelling evidence for the testimony of God's word in creation. Well, we need to wrap this session up. Let me just close by saying this. I told you I was going to leave you with a little cliffhanger. Because there is no evidence for evolution, we've never seen it in the fossil record, we've never seen it in the natural world, evolutionists have now redefined the word evolution. There is a new definition of evolution being promoted in our museums, in our universities, in our schools today. In fact, in your very scientific textbooks, for those of you in the public school, evolutionists have redefined the word evolution, and they're using a new definition. And if you come back in a few minutes, we'll get into this new definition of evolution. Let me just mention to you guys, if you're not going to stick around, and if you want more of this, obviously, I told you we flew through a lot of this, we skipped over a lot of this. I've got a CD album, a four CD album called Answering the Three Great Questions of Life. Two of the four CDs out there contain 2 hours worth of this information plus more that I haven't gotten into today. So if you're interested in this, this four CD album is $20. Great material, over 4 hours of information, and I'd highly recommend you go pick this up, check it out. We also have, if you're interested in these issues, two documentary DVDs for sale out there. One on the question of origins, which goes into a whole lot more examples from the animal kingdom and human anatomy that I talked about. Another CD, DVD on the age of the earth. And then there's a chapter of this in my father's book, Fast Facts on False Teaching. So I'd encourage you guys to check this out. It's all available in the back. And I appreciate you being with us today. God bless you guys.